From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the talking heads waited with bated breath on Friday for the release of the Democratic memo, which as of midday Friday was still on President Trump's desk, according to reports, it appears that the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Devin Nunes, is leaning towards a full disclosure of the FISA application, which he says shows that the Obama administration hid the fact that Democrats paid for the so-called Trump dossier when making an application for a FISA warrant to eavesdrop on then-Trump campaign advisor Carter Page.
Well, it's pretty clear that the American people have a right to know if there are FISA abuses. So if an American is being spied on using foreign intelligence capabilities of the United States of America, and it's wrong, and we discover that, we have to expose it. It's a very dangerous place to go because you will be releasing sources and methods. Okay, there's going to have to be a lot of things done. First of all, I think the FISA court needs to hold some of these folks in contempt, which they can do. Right? They basically lied to the court. They knew that the Democrats and the Hillary campaign had funded it. And that should have been front and center before a court. Right? If I'm a judge, and I think all American citizens can agree, if you're going to go to a secret court and get a warrant on a campaign, the first thing that they ought to be clear about is, hey, judge, we just want to let you know the other campaign paid for this. You had one campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign, working in conjunction with the Democratic National Committee, dug up dirt on Donald Trump that was phony dirt, gave it to the FBI, who then opened an investigation, a counterintelligence investigation, using our intelligence agencies to spy on an American citizen. It's really that simple. What happened is that the FBI presented the dossier as if it was true. And then they used a news article to corroborate this dossier, the dirt. But what they didn't say is that Steele, who wrote the dossier, also briefed the reporters. So you basically have and Steele was hired by the Hillary campaign. Either they didn't know, which would be bad, or they did know and they lied to the court. They actually went to great lengths to not tell anyone that the Democrats had paid for this and the Hillary campaign had paid for this. They went to such great lengths that they developed, there's a footnote that's still classified, but it's buried way deep, that you'd have to do, you'd have to do word math to try to put it all together to come up with that. It's basically designed, what I believe, to disguise the fact that the Democrats and the Hillary campaign paid for the dossier. So I find it very difficult to believe that the Department of Justice and FBI are going to be able to run this investigation themselves into everything that happened here. Because remember, this is only in phase one of this investigation dealing with FISA abuse. There's much, much more to come.
With dueling memos and soon-to-be dueling special prosecutors showing deep divisions inside the intelligence community, the government in general, and among the elites, we spoke with Professor Ward Churchill, author of the COINTELPRO papers, and asked if there were any historical precedents for the current situation. Is there any historical precedent to this kind of game? Because it seems, I remember all of the stuff with Nixon and with the CIA and the FBI, and some of the things that were going on earlier than that. I was born in 1954, so, the things that I saw from 1962 on, that history, I'm kind of pretty familiar with. I don't know anything like this, where there are these factions that, are making competing presentations and speaking through factions in the government with, I've got these top secret pieces of information from the intel community as opposed to I've got those. Have you ever seen anything like this, or is there historical precedent for this?
Not literally, although you would see some of that in the post-World War II era, where before Joe McCarthy stands up and says, his famous list of however many names,
Communist and State Department,
working in the government,
right?
Okay, and then with Parnell Thomas and HUAC and Nixon's rise in that, and they're making all sorts of allegations about the Republican administration, or excuse me, about the Democratic administrations really all through the 30s and right through the war, and including, by at least by implication, the Truman administration that was in power at the time. And you got some responses, but not like the ones that are going on now.
Yeah. Okay. And not for nothing, while that was going on, Truman is passing the National Security Act and, you know, creating the CIA and all this stuff.
You know, the loyalty oath program and all of that. So, again, there is a sort of a consensus, if you will. I mean, the accusations going back and forth, essentially the right wing of the Republicans was claiming that communist agents were running the State Department and so forth, and that was certainly being denied.
Right.
But it was a different sort than is the case now, and some of that may, in fact, be that publications were publications in those days, and you needed to have either control of a newspaper or be running some little rag that a couple hundred people read, or control of a radio station, which was pretty tightly controlled. TV wasn't even a major factor yet, as compared to what you have now with the blogosphere and all of that nonsense. So you've had the rise of that in the level of chatter, which is to say, in a way, distraction from what's actually going on. Okay? And there are political things going on, repressive things, COINTELPRO, if you will. Current example, the real deal. Not the stuff that's contrived about who's doing what to whom within inside the institutional box, but the thing that's going on with Black Lives Matter and other organizations being lumped together under the heading of Black Identity Extremists.
Right.
Okay, which is kind of like Black Nationalist Hate Groups. That was the caption that was used during COINTELPRO itself, secretly.
Right. Right.
Okay, until that stuff was disclosed in the 1970s. That was their, in their cryptonymic operation that was being carried out, COINTELPRO itself.
Wow.
All right. Yep. Well, you've got a guy now who's facing 10 years in Dallas for speech activities, captioned a Black Identity Extremist because he is prominent in the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, which is simply a Black organization drawing on a history of Second Amendment claims by so-called Black nationalist hate group, Black Panther Party, named for the head of the Black Panther Party, came up with the police thing, availing themselves of legal rights to carry unconcealed weapons in California. The law got changed as a result of their availing themselves of their rights. He's drawing on that tradition in the Black community and part of Black Lives Matter, too, as far as I can tell. He's facing 10 years simply for possession of two perfectly legal weapons. He is a convicted, he pled guilty to a misdemeanor domestic violence dispute in Tennessee, which makes it illegal, since it was domestic violence, for him to be in possession, although he's not a convicted felon, of a weapon. He didn't even know it. And they know he didn't know it, but evidence being used to deny him bond and prosecute him on these really serious charges. Evidence impounded was a copy of Robert F. Williams' Negroes with Guns.
Yeah, the book.
And various,
I think I have a copy of that, like from the late 60s or early 70s. Yeah.
Oh, no. That thing came out before that.
No, I know, but I was in high school.
You're talking a book that was first published circa 1960.
Yeah, I'm talking about when I was in high school.
How old now?
Well, 1960 makes it 68 years this year,
68 years now.
Yeah.
Well, when he was arrested, I think it was 67. In any event, two generations in the past, mere possession of the book.
Yeah.
And his speech activities are being invoked. That's it. He's got associations with groups advocating the rights of blacks, like just like the right wingers in this country, to bear arms.
Yep.
And defend themselves.
Yep.
Against armed attack. I mean, that's a position indistinguishable in a lot of ways from the National Rifle Association.
With the exception of a long history of black people actually being murdered that the people in the NRA haven't experienced. They've only read about.
Well, it's the FBI which is running the show in this.
Right. Yeah. Well, okay. This is a thing. This is a bipartisan project, obviously. You know, we're looking at an architecture that's been steadily constructed since the creation of the Bureau of Investigation, really. You had the Obama administration doing the whole sweep that they did against Occupy, for example, where they did all of this illegal intelligence work and then coordinate police activity nationally with local police departments to kick these people out.
Yep.
And just from one party to another.
Total confusion by the so-called left. Okay? Well, what's disarmed then? Oh.
Right.
I wonder why they want you disarmed.
Right.
You've got repression going on overtly, targeting in that, and the so-called left response is to reinforce what it is they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I don't think they see the connection between trying to take away your gun and telling Iraq that you can't have a weapon to defend yourself, or Korea, or whatever. It's the same exact game with the same enemy.
Yeah. But meanwhile, you got the these militias out doing standoffs with assault weapons, real assault weapons in some cases. Yeah. Not what they're passing off as assault weapons, which are lookalikes, but semi-automatic rather than select fire. Okay, out in Utah, and they're taking a seizure of federal land in Oregon. Well, it's not federal land. It belongs to the Indians out there. But in any case, you know, that's the construction put on it, and they're walking away free.
Yeah.
And the FBI is not taking the lead in prosecuting them. Now, this.
Well, part of that is
they can't bias, but it's not what Nancy Pelosi and friends are on about.
Yeah, yeah. There's the idea of these agencies being politicized is stated in simple terms. More or less, that's how you've outlined it. That it's political, but not in the sense that people are concerned about whether it's a Republican or a Democrat or this person or that person in office, but rather that the institution survives and that their relationship to the levers of power remains or improves. Right? Is that fair statement?
I mean, this is an oxymoron. How do you politicize for political police?
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
It's like criminalizing the Capone mob.
Right. Yeah, right. How do you criminalize the mafia? Yeah, so.
You're going to incline these people towards criminal activities. You keep it up.
Yeah.
I mean, they're political. It's a political entity. And performs political functions, but not in the arena that's all the dids are right now.
Right. Right. It's not the apparent, which is what people are discussing. Right. Professor,
it's
thank you.
It's a misdirection, big time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Yes, sir.
Another U.S. aerial attack in Syria, this one with 100 casualties among the Syrians. For more on this, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, analyst and senior lecturer at Moscow State University in International Relations. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow on Friday. All right, Mark, the U.S. is getting kind of brazen again, an attack on the Syrian Arab army inside its own territory.
Yeah, hey, Don. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
Our pleasure.
We have seen a whole range of escalations in Syria over the past 2 or 3 weeks. And this latest attack, this is the U.S. Occupation force in East Syria, in an area where their primary but not only proxy force is the Kurdish PKK majority, rebranded openly. I mean, we're talking U.S. generals openly admitted they decided to rebrand it as the Syrian Democratic Forces because openly working with the PKK was too too troublesome to their reputation.
In other words, because it sounds better. Turkey. Yeah, it sounds better.
It's better marketing.
Yeah, right.
When you have to sell democracy, trademark democracy, and trademark freedom, then right. then you know the best to use the best, most sophisticated branding.
That's right.
So the details of this attack are extremely murky. The U.S. is claiming the unalienable right of self-defense for their illegal invasion and military occupation of East Syria.
Right.
But it's by the U.S. claims that a Syrian Democratic Forces headquarters location, very, very careful wording there, were attacked by Syrian, pro-Syrian government forces.
In other words, the Syrian government.
No. Oh. Well, they may say it, but this is not what happened at all.
Oh, wow. Okay, so they're being very parsing the language very carefully. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is clear that no Syrian Arab army forces, or very few at least, were involved in this operation. So this all took place east of the Euphrates. The U.S. claims, as part of their partition of East Syria, that they have a gentleman's agreement with Russia and Syria, that basically everything east of the Euphrates, at least on that part of Syria, is theirs, while everything west of the Euphrates actually belongs to Syria. It's very nice. Russia and Syria and Iran and everyone else clearly and even Turkey clearly reject this notion and say there is no such agreement. It's simply where the race that we long talked about on this show for territory ended up. And it is not a hard border. There are spaces on both sides of the Euphrates River at various locations that the other side controls. And this happened on the east side of the Euphrates, particularly around an oil field that the Syrian government would like to regain control of for obvious reasons. And the U.S. would like to keep out of Syrian government hands for obvious reasons.
Right.
Just a couple weeks ago, under testimony in the Senate, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Satterfield explicitly said one of our aims there is to deny resources to the Syrian government in order to force the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad to step down, to make life more difficult and miserable for Syrians and to keep Syria weak, poor, and divided. I mean, that you can't get much more obvious than an open admission of what they're really doing there, as was outright said.
In other words, mm-hmm. they're saying we are occupying this portion of Syria, mm-hmm. of course, without a UN mandate, without an invitation or permission of the Syrian government. We're going to keep it until we can force a regime change in Damascus, regardless of the international community. That is patently illegal, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm not only illegal, it's also very stupid policy because that's simply not going to happen. And it sacrifices U.S. relations with Turkey and Iraq, which are not happy about the U.S.'s full embrace of Kurdish forces, which they regard as a separatist threat themselves on their own respective sides of the borders.
Right.
And it's simply not going to happen. They can't deny enough resources. They may not participate in the reconstruction of Syria. No one really asked the people that helped destroy it to participate in the reconstruction anyway. But China, Iran, Russia are certain, and other countries are more than likely to pick up the bill and it will enjoy the influence and investment that will be involved in the reconstruction.
And the U.S. now, is jacking up the cost of that, of course, by this resource denial, right?
Yeah, the largest. One of, if not the largest, and one of the largest remaining pockets of ISIS remaining is actually in wedged against U.S. controlled territory in East Syria up against the Iraqi border. And the U.S. and their proxies have shown no interest in doing anything against them. because it maintains their pretext, which of course they have now expanded on. They've openly said they want regime change in Damascus, even if they're not going to do it by even if they say they're not going to do it by military confrontation with the Syrian government. They want to weaken Iranian influence in the country because obviously Syria doesn't have the right to form allies with who and what it wants. You know, the U.S. gets to dictate that to other countries in the world. But they're also not finishing the job with ISIS against a weakened pocket that's remaining, you know, without any large urban areas there, simply because they need to maintain a pretext of that's why they're in Syria. Now, the exact area in question that the countering claims of attacks, this oil field was controlled by a combination of local Arab tribes that had previously been under ISIS, were bought out by the United States. All right. I mean, they may have participated with ISIS because someone had agreed with it. Some of it, you know, may have been done under pressure, you know, and their threat of extermination or so on. They were bought out by the U.S. and that way, that was how the U.S. advanced so quickly on the east bank of the Euphrates, down past Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor, is because they simply bought out ISIS affiliated tribes, you know, to their side. Now they've gone even further and they've taken actual ISIS fighters and claimed they've been rehabilitated, is the word they use, rehabilitated ISIS fighters. And wow, they have merged several hundred of theirs into their hodgepodge of proxy forces in East Syria. And they may be very well continuing to do that.
Rehab. Wow. Rehab for jihadis. Do they use methadone or anything or what?
They're recovering. It's a 12-step program.
Got it.
Yeah. So this oil field was held by a combination of these local Arab tribes and the SDF. Evidently, these local Arab tribes not happy, as most of the Arabs, in East Syria are not happy being ruled over by Kurds. They switched sides, evidently, and decided to go to cooperate at least with the Syrian government. There seems that there was some order by the U.S. to the Syrian Democratic Forces to not resist this and to pull back from the position. It's not clear that there were any U.S. troops there. This may have been a miscommunication. It may have been a deliberate trap. All right. It's not sure. But these local Arab tribes were backed up by other local Arab tribe militias, by two towns on the east side of the Euphrates that are actually controlled by the Syrian government. This was, you know, as a result of the race for land, the Syrian government managed to get a foothold at this area on the other side of the Euphrates. It's close by. And then the U.S. claims that the Syrian Democratic Forces attack position was attacked. And they responded with overwhelming firepower.
Yeah, you know, Mattis, meanwhile, said, geez, you know, we have no idea why that happened. We were talking with the Russians and all of that. They knew that the SDF was there. We don't know. He called it perplexing.
Everyone seems to be perplexed. Right. I'm not sure that Mattis is actually the one who is perplexed in this situation.
Yeah, right.
But supposedly, these they called them Syrian affiliated, Syrian pro-Syrian government forces, mostly local Arab tribes, moved into this area. The U.S. claims it was attacked and responded with overwhelming firepower. They said that one Syrian Democratic Forces proxy was wounded and that they killed 100 of the pro-Syrian government. Now, that doesn't really sound like an attack and a counterattack to
me. Right.
From my military experience.
Yeah,
but
right.
The details are not clear, but regardless, of course, you know, the U.S. has no right, or, you know, nor its proxies any right to self-defense in Syrian territory with an illegal invasion and military occupation.
Right.
But this is only the host of a series of escalations. In the past 2 weeks, just over a week, we have seen the Erdogan's forces, accompanied by his Islamist proxies and actually by allied, literal al-Qaeda forces, try to make an advance to cut off Syrian Arab army advances in Idlib. Twice he has been chased off by Syrian artillery and remonstrations from Russia. So this is an actual exchange of fire twice in the past week by Syrian government and Turkish forces. Iran is and Syria are increasingly telling Turkish government to stop their military attack on the Kurdish canton of Afrin, which was previously under a Russian peacekeeping agreement. Russia pulled out ahead of the Turkish advance, and there's a lot of gameplay there between Turkey and the United States. There was also a Russian plane that was shot down over Idlib by Turkish-backed jihadis, in this case a subgroup that was previously armed by the CIA, Jaish al-Nasser, operating under the umbrella, of course, of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham or al-Qaeda in East Idlib. And the pilot parachuted out, was engaged in a gunfight on the ground, and then evidently pulled the pin on a grenade and blew himself up in order to avoid capture, torture, and beheading by the jihadis. Saying this is for the boys,
right.
And we know all of this because the jihadis filmed their attack on the down pilot.
Yep. So all right. So we've got
and one more.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
There was actually two massive drone attacks on Russian military bases. It was presented as if it was ad hoc attacks, but the Russian military says it was actually quite advanced and coordinated. It's not exactly clear whether it was U.S.-backed or Turkish-backed or some combination of those. And Russian aid distribution centers and a Russian consulate were also attacked by mortar attacks in the past week. So there's a lot of escalation going on between this three-way Mexican standoff between Russia and the Syrian government and Iran on one side, Turkey and al-Qaeda, and it's 31 flavors of jihad on the other, and the U.S., and it's Syrian Democratic Kurdish allied forces on the other. In recent hours, we just have word out, Al-Masdar, it's not being reported on much, so don't take this as a confirmation, you know, but as we're recording, Al-Masdar is reporting that the U.S. forces, backed forces, in this case, the Deir Azor High Military Council, which is actually not part of the Syrian Democratic Forces. It's totally local Arabs that are directly on the paycheck of the U.S. State Department and armed by the Pentagon, so there's no confusion about who they're operating right. are attacking the two Syrian government towns that I mentioned, controlled towns, on the east side of the Euphrates in full force as we speak. And this would seem to now be an attempt, right after that recent altercation in the same area, to drive the Syrian government completely off to the east bank of the Euphrates and firm up the U.S. And their proxy partition of that part of East Syria. I would say, actually, that Russia and the U.S. are both engaged in a type of brinkmanship, not only against each other, but they're each trying to egg the Turks on to attacking the other side. Russia would like the Turks to concentrate, is concentrating on convincing the Turks that the U.S. Alliance with the Kurds is a threat to them, and Turkey should attack the U.S.-supported Kurds in Manbij, while the U.S. would like to split the Turkish Russian geopolitical dance. I don't want to call it an alliance because right. It's anything but this
relationship.
Austin-Aw agreement.
Yeah. And we got to stop here, Mark. Thank you very much. Yeah. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.